In 1935, Sir Charles Kingsford Smith was a hero to Australia. A World War I flying ace, Smithy had returned to civilian life to embark on a series of record-breaking flights in his little fixed-wing Fokker aircraft, the Southern Cross. In the plane he fondly called the old bus, the dashing flying ace had made the first transatlantic flight to Australia from the mainland US. And while Australians know of his great partnership with Charles Ulm, very few likely remember the name Sir Gordon Taylor. Known as Bill, Taylor was another pioneer aviator, best remembered as the man who saved Smithy during a disastrous flight delivering the mail across the Tasman Sea to New Zealand. Thousands of miles from land, with one engine out and the oil pressure on another beginning to drop, Bill braved a howling slipstream, edged out onto the plane's wing and siphoned oil from a disabled engine to keep them in flight. Indiana Jones, eat your heart out. Well, my guest today is Bill Taylor's biographer, Rick Searle, author of The Man Who Saved Smithy. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Ellen.
I loved your book. Let's start at the beginning. The boyhood obsessions of the young Bill Taylor, an intriguing little boy. What were his obsessions?
His obsessions were the water and the bush and islands. The family was fairly well off. His father owned Sydney Ferries before the bridge went over, so there was plenty of ferries.
And plenty of money.
They also owned a plant that made coke for the ferries, so they were well off. And they were also importers of whiskey and rope, so P.T. Taylor was the family. And his father was also in the state legislature. So right from an early age, there were rich people and influential people in the household. They lived at Mossman, but they also had a property at Bayview up on Pittwater in the days when the road to Pittwater was quite just a rough track and it was unspoiled. And I think his father actually leased Scotland Island for a while, which is in Pittwater, and used to run horses across to it. And the image of horses swimming across that narrow channel to Scotland Island is something that impressed me when I was reading his books. So that was Bill. And in the weekends, he used to paddle a canoe and explore the bush and collect birds' eggs. And then as he got older, his father got him a little skiff and his older brothers taught him to sail a 16-foot skiff. And he used to take big risks in that, put a lot of sail on it and come to grief in a southerly buster. He actually sailed this. The skiff was called Weary Willie, the one he learnt on. And then he was given one when he was about 16 called Query, which he kept seaworthy for the rest of his life. Now, the thing at Pittwater, which really was a signature thing in Bill's life, was Lion Island, which, as some people from the Sydney area would know, lies right in the head of Broken Bay, at the mouth of Broken Bay. It looks like a lion guarding the entrance. Well, Bill sailed there in his school holidays, and he actually set up a campsite. And he used to take great delight in his teens of sailing up there to Lion Island and anchoring off the cove and catching fish and cooking it.
By himself?
A lot of it was by himself, but there was one other boy called Frank Roche that he befriended. And Frank was Bill's kind of guy. Actually, in one of his books, Bill talks about some of the kids from I think it's probably Shaw or could have been Mossman Press. No, it would have been Shaw.
These are school friends.
School friends. They came up to Pittwater with him and he dismissed them at once because they were useless in boats and didn't know how to catch fish. So he was pretty selective in his friends. You wouldn't say he was a loner, but that's the start of his life.
And even at that early beginnings, there's a steel in that little boy's character, isn't there?
Yes, and there's a good example of that. He and Frank Roche used to build sandcastles. Probably kids today wouldn't know it, but back in those days, sand gardens, there were big sand garden competitions. I've seen photographs of hundreds of these gardens decorated with shells and things and sandcastles. Excuse me. Well, Bill built some sandcastles, he and Frank, and these bigger kids from up the beach came and kicked them down. So Bill and Frank built the sandcastles again, but they broke bottles and embedded them neck down in the sand. So when the kids came back next time, they cut their feet quite badly.
On jagged glass.
So it was a Pyrrhic victory because Bill and Frank spent the rest of the holidays avoiding these kids. So that shows the sort of guy he was. You don't mess around with him.
You don't mess with Bill Taylor.
No.
He was 8 years old when he was packed off to school. I think they would call it today school refusal. There were several incidents of school refusal. How determined was he not to go to school?
Well, when he went to Mossman Prep, little fella, he went one or two days and he said, I don't like that, I don't want to go back to school. And his mother said, she's pretty shrewd, she said, you've got a choice, you can go to school or you can go to bed. He said, I'll go to bed. So he, after the second day in bed, she wouldn't let him out, she wouldn't let him out of bed, apart from necessaries, of course. So he said, I'll go to school. So he put up with Mossman Prep. Then he went to Shaw. Now, this was an important part, important sort of indication of the type of man he was right through his life. He didn't fit well into structured organisations. Now, those private schools, if you do the right thing and play the right sport and join the right club, you become a prefect and you work through this clearly structured leadership thing. Mm. That wasn't for Bill Taylor. So he just refused to go to Shaw. And I wasn't able to find documentary evidence of this, but it's a family folklore that he got into Queery and he sailed
along. That's the boat.
That's the little boat. He sailed to Lion Island and set up camp and refused to come off the island.
How old was he?
Oh, he would have been, say, 14.
Right.
And his father, again, there's no documentary evidence of this, but Bill glosses over it because it's a bit of a defeat for him. His father eventually reached an agreement with him. He'd go to the Armidale School, which was miles from the sea, and he said, right, I'll go to the Armidale School. And he did very well at the Armidale School. He decided, look, I've got to be here. I might as well do the right thing. And he played in the football. He was a head of school or prefect or something, quite a high level. So if he put his mind to it, he could do it. But he was never really happy in an organisation.
We're coming to the character of the man, which is important. He's a very sober and serious person, we'll discover as we go along. But at this point of the book, I really wanted to meet him. I really wanted to figure out what he was like. Was he a true pioneer who couldn't be tied down? Or, and there's some testy correspondence he has later in his life, you know, writes to the Prime Minister, Sir Robert Menzies, and basically says, you're a fool. Yeah. So is he a pioneer or is he sort of an upper-class rich young man who thinks everybody else is not up to scratch and you can all go to hell in a handbasket?
I don't think he was either of those. I think he was a bloke who was just living his own life. He wasn't. There is no stage, I don't think, where he said, I am going to be a pioneer aviator. No stage at all. In fact, he, as a child, he wasn't even interested in aeroplanes. He sort of fell into that as a result of the First World War. Mm. When the war came, he was at school. He thought, yippity-doo-dah, I can get out and have an adventure now, because he was an adventurous person, and off he went to the war. And first they wouldn't let him in, so he joined the army in Australia. And then he one day in a magazine on the train, he saw this magazine showing aeroplanes bombing some airship sheds in Europe. He thought, that's for me.
So he's looked at a magazine, seen a plane, and thought, what, how hard could it be?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, he thought, this will do me, because he didn't want to be a soldier in the trenches. But all those guys who went to the First World War, they did it for adventure. It's all God, King and Country and excitement. And that's where they all flocked and they all were killed, a lot of them were. So Bill actually got his father to use his influence to get him into the Royal Flying Corps in England.
So he's 18 years old.
17 or 18, yeah.
17 or 18, he says, right, I'll be a fighter pilot. And Dad pulls the strings. He lucks an interview with a colonel from the Royal Flying Corps in London. What's the critical question the colonel needs answered to?
Can you ride a horse? And Bill said, yes. And he said, right, you're in. But that was common with those guys. I think the misconception was, maybe not a misconception, if you could ride a horse, you had a great sense of balance, so you could fly the aeroplanes of the day, and they were really hairy things to fly.
So he starts this adventure, which at this point is sounding like Blackadder and Captain Darling. Hello,
it's
darling.
It's almost comical, except it's not.
Can you fly a horse? And he arrives at training only to meet a very unusual instructor who was to instruct him in the business of flying a plane.
Yes, he was given this instructor. Now, the aeroplane they learned on was a Farman, which was like a bathtub with one wing on top of the other and an engine in the back, uncomfortably close to your neck, and if you had a crash, the engine would come right through and make a mess of you. So this instructor said, get in, I'm going to show you some landings. And Bill thought to himself, why would you show me how to land when you haven't shown me how to take off yet? And they took off. And there wasn't a word of instruction. They had to yell, of course, because of the noise, but there was not a word. And they went round in a circuit and landed. Then the instructor said in his ear, right, you do one. And he took the aeroplane off and then handed it over to Bill. And, of course, Bill didn't know how to land. He hadn't been shown. So he made a hell of a mess of it. And the instructor said, "That's dreadful. Let's do it again." So they took off and did another circuit. And Will was waiting for the guy to give him some instruction. And they came in and landed. And the instructor said, "That's better." And Bill thought, "What was better? I thought you were flying the plane."
So he wasn't aware he had, in fact, landed the aircraft.
He didn't actually. He had his hands off. It just landed through sheer luck. And that just shook Bill to the core because he wasn't being taught properly. So he thought, they went in and overnight he talked over with one of his mates and he said, "This guy's incompetent. And as well as that, he's dangerous." So the next morning when they got in the aircraft, the instructor gave him some instruction and Bill just thought, "Nah." So he turned off the engine. Now that's really defying the order of a superior officer. He said, "I don't want to fly with you anymore." And then to his surprise, the instructor said, "Okay, we'll come in and we'll find you another instructor." And they got another instructor and he learnt no trouble at all. And it turned out this poor guy was shell-shocked and they'd shunted him into instructing as a means of giving him something to do. And he actually was responsible for the death of one of Bill's colleagues because he wasn't teaching them properly. And those aeroplanes in those days were very unforgiving and you could kill yourself very, very quickly in them.
It was very dangerous not only flying in active service in the First World War, but just training, as you say, could be very dangerous. There's an air of unreality about it all too. Can I get you to read for me Bill's account of witnessing a colleague die in France even before they had seen active service?
This is in a SOP with Pup. "He was coming down steeply with engine on, firing, but holding his dive beyond the time when he should have started to pull out. I was in agony, trying to will him out of the dive before it was too late. He must have realised his mistake, seen the ground coming up, and pulled back far too heavily on the stick. With a ridiculously harmless sound, like a child's balloon bursting, the aeroplane disintegrated. The fuselage dived straight into the ground with the crunching noise of somebody treading on a matchbox."
He's a terrific writer, but there's sound there that it's not quite real for that 18-year-old boy.
Well, the words he used, like treading on a matchbox, it's something very sinister. There's a life snuffed out and it makes no more sound than a matchbox being trodden on.
Yeah. And no more sense. Was there that sense of detachment from the horrors of war for those who weren't in the trenches, who were in the air?
There was, in two ways. One, because of their lifestyle, that the guys, as we've all seen this year in the centenary or the commemoration of the First World War, the tremendous conditions they lived in the trenches. They lived in mud, they died in mud, they slept in the mud, and there was no let out from the mud. But the fighter pilots, Bill Taylor lived with little tents pitched in an apple orchard. They had a mess and they used to go into town, into the local village and buy things to decorate their quarters. And so they lived this strange life. Most of the time it was terribly civilised. And then they'd go up over the trenches and fight with the likelihood of a fiery death.
And when you say go up over the trenches, you mean
fly up over the trenches. 17, 18, 20,000 feet over the trenches with no oxygen. And he was flying a little 80-horsepower aeroplane against much more powerful German planes. And he saw a lot of his colleagues shot down. And then they come back and sit in the apple orchard and take tea. So that is really unrealistic. That's really living in two parallel universes, really. I think the reality, it was all still a big adventure, but one afternoon in his very first or second encounter with the enemy, he said, "This was not like a game of football. The winner of this battle is going to end in someone's death." And he thought, "Gee, this is not a sports game. This is for real, boy." And he said, "I determined the death would not be mine, or I determined the death would be his." I forget the exact words. Mm. So that's when reality hit. This is not a game. They're all playing a big, glorious empire game.
He's also developing his character as a pilot at this stage.
Yes.
And there's nothing of the devil-may-care flying ace about him, is there?
No, not at all. He's very. This is why he survived so long. He took it very seriously. And also he has one of his fitters to thank too, otherwise he would have been killed. He came back from a sortie one day and he noticed a group of guys standing around the tail of his aeroplane And he walked over to them and they were pointing, and the control wires had been shot away during the dogfight that he just had. And he would have had no control over his aeroplane at all, and he would have been killed. But his fitter, on his own initiative, had fitted a duplicate set of control wires which weren't shot away. So he owes his life to that bloke, Corporal Ellens, his name was. And he tried to contact him in later life, and I think he did, and wrote a letter to him. So pretty dangerous profession.
There was a moment when the brutal nature of what he was doing really hit home for him. And I'll get you to read another passage from the book. He's in a dogfight with a German Rumpler aircraft, which was a single-engine, two-seat biplane. Can you read Bill's own account of what happened next?
This is when he shot the Rumpler down, actually. So he fired on it and he shot at it. There was a he saw an orange tongue of flame came out of it and it was on fire. And it started to go down. And then he wrote, "A black object detached itself from the blazing Rumpler. A grotesque thing with loose and waving ends. The rear gunner had jumped from the death by fire to which my action had condemned him. He appeared to fall quite slowly, passing my machine as though he were almost floating in space. And then he was gone, invisible against the dark earth. For the first time, I was horror-stricken by the result of war in the air."
And was that a key moment for him?
It sure was. From that day onwards, he'd resolved that his career lay in the air, but it was in the peaceful exploitation of the air, planning routes across the major oceans. He was repulsed by the whole scene. And typical of Bill Taylor, he got himself out of the war. He got himself sent back to Australia. That's the essential thing about Bill Taylor. Most soldiers, "Oh, this is terrible, but you've got to keep going. They shoot you for desertion." Not Bill. He moved things so that he could be returned to England and then subsequently to quite honourably with the rank of captain, which he was allowed to keep for the rest of his life.
He won a military cross for bravery at that time. And he has that in common with Charles Kingsford Smith. And I wanted you to take me now to 1930. Both men have got a military cross. Kingsford Smith's just 28 years old. What's his reputation, Smithy?
Well, he and Charles Ulm were national heroes, of course, after flying the Pacific. And Smithy used to barnstorm, and he had a very good with the media, we'd say today. He had a terrific grin and very photogenic.
Handsome.
Yep, and he talked on the newsreels and talked on the radio. So that was his image. In the long term, it probably wasn't the best image for him to have, but in those days, that's what he had, and he enjoyed it. He loved it.
And how different was his demeanour to Bill's?
Well, at that stage, of course, Bill didn't even know him. Bill was a rich man about town, member of the Union Club, used to like nice cars and yachts. He'd bought himself a little gypsy moth aeroplane, which he fitted with floats and used to fly out of Pittwater. We flew all the way to Cairns and down to Hobart in it. So he was a different fellow altogether. And he absolutely idolised Smithy, though.
And what was the difference in their, if you like, risk appetite between the two men? Did Smithy have a greater appetite for risk?
Absolutely. I think Smithy tried to avoid risks, but I think he accepted a greater degree of risk. Bill Taylor was very sophisticated, I thought, after reading his story, in his approach to what we now call risk management. I don't think they even called it that in those days, but he always said you never play your last card. You always have a couple of things going, so if all hell breaks loose, you've always got that last card.
Mm.
And he did play his last card a couple of times. He couldn't avoid it. But Smithy was a much more swashbuckling character.
And so if he'd had a few drinks over dinner and some pretty girls and some friends, were they likely to go for a bit of a joy flight?
Indeed they did. And they went up one evening after a dinner party, the group of them went out in the Southern Cross and they pranged it. I don't think anyone was seriously hurt, but that's, you know, Bill Taylor might make him sound boring, but he would not have done that. Number one, he wouldn't have had a lot of drinks. He wasn't a big drinker.
Yeah.
And he certainly wouldn't have cavorted around the sky like that, no.
Now, how do their paths cross, these two men?
Well, they first met when Bill Taylor was flying for Australian National Airways, which was an airline that Charles Ulm set up and in partnership with Smithy in a very brave attempt to start a regular airline service between Sydney and Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane. And they used similar aeroplanes to the Southern Cross, They were Fokkers, but they were licensed built in England. They were called Avro 10s. They carried 8 passengers and 2 crew, hence the name Avro 10. Now, Bill Taylor, following on from the war, wanted to make a career in the air, so he applied for a job with Ullens Airline, and he got a job as a captain eventually, flying between Sydney and Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane. It was routine airline flying, but it was one hell of a way to run an airline because they didn't have any good weather reports. They had the most rudimentary blind flying equipment, and Smithy was one of the pilots, so that's when Bill would have met him. That's how their path crossed. But he was just a young line captain, and Smithy was the big hero.
And so here he was at Australian National Airlines. Let's just take a moment on that. ANA, nice, safe airline, was it, Rick?
By today's standards, they weren't. But if you look back at them, it was the best that Charles Ulm could have made. He had the latest equipment aboard. He employed experienced pilots, but it used to take 5 hours to get from Sydney to Melbourne in flying in cloud because they couldn't climb above the weather. And, of course, we all know that the Southern Cloud, eventually one of those aeroplanes was lost, and it was in the snowy mountains there for 32 years, unfound.
But even a successful flight between Sydney and Melbourne, if you were one of the 8 out the back and you were just throwing up to the point of exhaustion, that you got off pretty lightly, didn't you, on ANA? That was a good flight.
That was a good flight you made. They didn't have many prangs. Bill Taylor writes about one flight he took in his early days with a famous aviator called James Mollison as the captain. And they were over in cloud heading towards Melbourne, and Taylor thought, well, sooner or later we've got to come down to land in Melbourne. We don't know what the wind is. We don't know what the drift is. We don't know where we are. Now, there's high land north of Melbourne. We either run the risk of coming down over the sea if we keep going too long, or we run down, come into the mountains. And Mollison suddenly just said, I think we'll go down now, and pulled the power off, and down they went, and it came through a hole in the cloud, and there was Essendon Airfield. And Bill was just gobsmacked. How did you do that? And he asked Mollison later, and Mollison said, well, actually, I, at my side of the aeroplane, I saw a hole in the cloud and I recognised the terrain. I knew I just worked it out through sheer luck. Now, that's not a good way to run an airline, is it?
Not ideal, no. He wrote about the pilots for ANA, and he said of them, this is Taylor, they had to be sensitive, intelligent, with imagination that could project itself forward to situations well ahead of the aircraft and therefore capable of fear. The conventional conception of the strong and silent He-Man, fearless, is a great menace in the air. His days are numbered from the start.
That's pretty advanced thinking for those times. Yeah, the public misconception or the public image of aviators was swashbuckling, risk-taking, fearless people. And even though people adored Kingsford Smith, he was far from fearless, and that fear manifested itself in some panic attacks, which he used to have. And he had an absolute pathological fear of coming down in the ocean, which is a terrible thing for someone to have who does massive transoceanic flights.
Mm. Take us to that flight, the first flight that Bill Taylor had with Smithy, the first big flight. They're flying to New Zealand, and as you say, that panic attack comes on.
Yeah,
how does it present itself?
Bill Taylor sold himself to Smithy as a navigator, and Taylor said, right, I'm taking the Southern Cross to New Zealand. You can be my navigator. And that was Bill's first test of his long-distance overwater navigation skills. And he succeeded. He really learned to trust his instruments as a navigator on that flight. But coming back to Sydney, Smithy suddenly said, take over, will you, and went down to the cabin. And Bill looked behind, and there was Smithy absolutely prostrate on the mailbags. He was totally a gibbering wreck. He'd succumbed to a panic attack. And Bill Taylor, the first he'd seen that his hero was capable of fear like that. And when they landed in Sydney, Smithy picked himself up and smiled at the cameras, and everything was okay again. But that happened a number of times. Quite often before major flights, Smithy used to get the flu, which was probably psychosomatic in origin.
Mm. And just briefly, did Taylor think anything less of him for that?
No, I think he was a little bit puzzled. But no, not less of him, because he's demonstrably a very brave man, Smithy.
On air, online, and on your mobile. This is Conversations on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
And my guest is Rick Searle, author of a wonderful new book, The Man Who Saved Smithy. It's the story of an aviation pioneer, Bill Taylor, who served with distinction as a fighter pilot in the skies over France and Germany in the First World War, and returned to make a name for himself alongside the heroes of the age, Charles Kingsford Smith, and another Charles, Smithy's co-pilot and collaborator, Charles Ulm. Now, Rick, Bill Taylor was quite a writer, and when you started working on his biography, you found a little scrap of paper that must have made the blood drain from your face.
Yes, there are 95 boxes in the Bill Taylor's papers in the National Library, and I spent a week there going through all the documents and photographing documents on my iPad, and I shudder to think what the photocopying costs would have been. And I came across just a small piece of paper, but probably 3 or 4 centimetres square, with writing on it in pencil, and it said, "Someday somebody's going to write about my life. I'm doing this from memory now, dot, 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 but they'll probably get it wrong, dot, 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 so I might as well do it myself." And I thought, boy, oh boy, because I'd been thinking of writing this book and I was thinking of writing it in my words. Mm. And I thought, now look, to do this man justice, he's written 7 beautiful books. What I'll do is write it in my words. It'll be my book, but I'll incorporate his writings into the book where I think it's the correct thing to do, and that's what I did. Yeah. And I hope I've done him justice.
No pressure, though.
No, a bit of pressure, yes.
With that scrap of paper sitting beside you as you're writing? Don't muck it up, Rick.
No.
Don't muck it up.
Quite frankly, I think if he'd been around, he would have given me a hard time during the writing.
I want to take you to the years 1933 and 1934. Bill Taylor's met Smithy. He's been on one flight with him in which he's seen that the great man has feet of clay. He has this panic attack. But there's lots of flying in the years 33 and 34. Lots of attempts to break records for long-haul flights, often designed with a commercial aim in mind. Why were they doing all this?
Well, Charles Ulm and Kingsford Smith both had ambitions to start a regular airline flying the mail across to New Zealand and also up to Singapore to connect with the Imperial Airways mail service to England. And after the Southern Cloud disaster and ANA closed down, Smithy and Ulm went separate ways. So one of the things Smithy wanted to do was to... typical Smithy, let's do a stunt to get support.
So that when he put in the tender to run the airmail service, they'd say, we best give it to Smithy.
That's sort of in a nutshell, yes. Mm. So he decided he got this new aeroplane from the United States, which in itself was a contentious thing because in those days everyone knew in Australia that the British built the best aeroplanes, except that they didn't. The Americans were building the best aeroplanes. So Smithy bought this aeroplane. It was a Lockheed Altair. Which he called initially Anzac and got into trouble and changed it to Lady Southern Cross. He tried to enter into the Centenary Air Race from England to Australia, but he messed that up. I won't go into that now. But they decided to do an alternative thing, and that was to fly the Lady Southern Cross across the Pacific from Brisbane to San Francisco.
So this is 12,000 kilometres in a single-engine aeroplane.
That's right. A very reliable engine, but it still was a single-engine aeroplane, yes.
There was a horrific mix-up, which could have killed them both on that journey. What happened?
Before they left Sydney to fly up to Brisbane to start the flight, they ran some fuel consumption tests and worked at the throttle settings at which they could be most economical in flying so they could have the range to get across first to Fiji, then to Honolulu, then to San Francisco. But someone mucked up the figures. So on the flight from Brisbane to Sydney, this is Bill Taylor, he thought he'd double-checked them. So he took a very careful check of the film and dipped the tanks and everything. And when he got to Brisbane, to their shock and horror, they found out that they didn't have the range to go across the Pacific. They couldn't reach Fiji. Although the longer leg, they couldn't reach Fiji to Honolulu.
So they're finding this out as they're about to set off.
Yes, because they had the wrong figures. So Smithy didn't want to pull out of that as well, because he'd pulled out of the centenary air race. He didn't want egg on his face. So Bill Taylor said, hang about, let's run another fuel consumption test with a different throttle setting. So they filled the airplane up and flew from Cape Moreton to somewhere else in Moreton Bay and measured it and determined the correct fuel setting. Mm. They said, yes, we have got enough fuel if we go a bit slower. So that was Bill Taylor's thinking. That's his methodical approach. So away they went. So that's one of Bill Taylor's things.
They get off into the air. Things are going quite well. And then quite suddenly, they're not. Can you read Bill's description of yes. what it feels like when things go wrong?
It was in the night time. And that Bill could sense that something was wrong with the aeroplane. It wasn't flying properly. It was sort of squashing along in the air. Now, it's absolute darkness. They can't see anything. But he could, both are pilots, and he knew something was wrong, and he could sense that Smithy was doing everything in his power to prevent the aeroplane stalling, an aerodynamic stall, when they just fall out of the sky. Suddenly, the aeroplane stalled. Now, this is Bill. I feel that I have been thrown upwards without the machine, then back unnaturally in the seat. The whole world is waving about, and there is a tightness in my head. The engine stops. Smithy has shut it off. Immediately there is a scream from the klaxon that warns about the undercarriage when the throttle is shut. All around us there is the whirling sound of the shrieking klaxon as though it were violently swung on the edge of a string, and the tight feeling and flinging of the machine. Spinning. It is a fantastic whirling madness in the centre of black infinity.
As they're plunging towards the Pacific. Mm. What had gone wrong, Rick?
Well, Smithy was concerned about icing, ice forming on the leading edges of the wings, which of course changes the shape of the wing and loses its ability to lift. So he kept turning the landing lights on to get a bit of a look at the wing. And the landing light switch was right next to the flap switch, and he'd inadvertently put the flaps down.
So and what happens when you put, for the uninitiated, what happens when you put the flaps down?
Well, the flaps put a large amount of drag into the, and the poor old engine's struggling, but there's so much drag, they're designed to bring you into land, not cruise over the Pacific Ocean. So the aeroplane just couldn't fly. And Smithy was doing his best, and suddenly it just wouldn't fly and it stalled, and that's why it was spinning down in a corkscrew towards the ocean.
Were they losing altitude badly?
They were, but in a spin you lose altitude at a very high rate of knots, but the airspeed doesn't climb because the aeroplane's stalled.
So how close to the ocean did they get?
Well, they went down to about 8,000 feet or so, I think, or maybe a little bit lower, and then Smithy gradually brought her out. He got her. Just superb airmanship, that's all it was, through the seat of his pants. And then finally he said, I turned the wrong switch. Pretty scary stuff.
And is there any record of what Bill Taylor says over the Pacific with his heart in his chest when Smithy says, oh, sorry, mate? Wrong switch.
Only in his writing. All his writings are very well-mannered. When he doesn't like things or he's a bit taken aback, he's terribly well-mannered. He doesn't say what he really thinks. But I think he must have thought at times with Smithy, goodness gracious me, what have I got myself in for here, you know.
There's another occasion where he flies with Charles Ulm. And they're flying the Faith in Australia, which is a very good name for a plane. Planes at this stage of the game, Rick, were rubbish, weren't they? Absolute rubbish. I mean, there are stories in your book of landing in paddocks, having to take off on, I mean, bits falling off them, engines coming apart. I mean, it was madness.
By modern standards, they were. I mean, it was a bit of a wing and a prayer type of stuff. There's no doubt about that. The Faith in Australia and Southern Cross were both steel tubes, basically covered with canvas and plywood, with a great big wooden wing on top, and three pretty reliable engines, but they still had troubles.
There's a part in the book where Taylor writes of that flight across Australia with Ulm. They're trying to go around the world. That doesn't work out. We fly with the night, he writes. Secure in peace. Suddenly, all three engines backfire in rapid succession and stop. Terrific. Terrific. And this was not unusual, was it?
No, and that had nothing to do with the reliability of the engines. That was the way they had the aeroplane configured. They had a pump that would transfer fuel from a fuselage tank up to a higher tank to feed the engines, and the pump failed. So they didn't know the pump had failed. They thought they were pumping fuel, and they weren't. And suddenly the engines ran out of fuel. They stopped. That's why they all stopped simultaneously. They thought very, very quickly what's going on, and they soon twigged to what it was, and they had to start pumping up, just doing a bodgy job, really, of getting the fuel up. They suffered from the pump was leaking petrol all over the floor. They started to throw up from the fumes. They took turns at pumping and then shoving their head out of the window so they could get fresh air. And they did that for hours through the night over the Western Australia till they reached Derby.
And he writes of that, Charles Ulm, said, "I did not bat an eyelid when the engines cut out without warning in the night. I should like to cultivate the strong, silent idea, but the truth is that on these occasions," this is a wonderful description, "one is momentarily frozen into a false appearance of nonchalance by the enormity of the thing, which is so shattering that it seems automatically to produce a voluntary effort of will which controls one's more involuntary impulse to grasp frantically at everything in sight." He was a good man in a crisis, wasn't he?
That pretty well sums him up. But I mean, the things that were going on behind his facade would have been absolute turmoil. But he was a pretty cool dude in today's language when things went wrong, and he managed to think quite quickly when he had to. Charles Ulm really wasn't as intuitive a pilot as Smithy and Bill. He was a pilot and he's a terrific organiser, but Bill, mind you, Charles Ulm was pretty cool too when all three engines failed.
It's the 15th of May, Rick, 1935, and Taylor and Smithy are cooking something up. What are they attempting to do and why?
Well, Smithy is trying to fly yet one more mail flight across the Tasman Sea. It's a commemorative flight for the 25th anniversary of King George V. And they managed to get a load of mail, and the whole aim of this was to impress the government with the reliability of Smithy's ability to fly across the Tasman Sea. Bill Taylor wasn't happy with the serviceability of one of the engines on the Southern Cross, but they took it anyway, and he was a little bit tentative about it.
But it was more than tentative about it. I mean, why were they in this jolly old bus? What sort of condition was it in for this flight?
Well, Smithy admitted that she was on her last leg. She'd done a lot of things at the Southern Cross. But he was driven by the necessity to do this signature flight and get some support.
And so how bad a condition was she in?
Prior to the flight, they had to completely dismantle one of the engines and rebuild it. And Bill Taylor wasn't happy. At one stage, they were going to take two aeroplanes, the Faith in Australia and the Southern Cross, but they couldn't get enough freight and mail to make it an economical proposition, so they just took the cross at the last minute, just as the one aeroplane.
There were ominous signs. He writes that, you know, a few days before they leave, he comes into the hangar and one of the engines is all over the ground.
That's right. That's the one. And what disturbed him more was that the main engineer was working somewhere else on another engine, so the actual Smithy, no, it wasn't Smithy, it was a journalist, Jack Percival, and someone else were reassembling this engine. They weren't even proper mechanics. But that was aviation in those days. Everyone mucked in and did their best.
Journalists fixing engines, that's terrifying.
Yeah, well, it would have been under Smithy's supervision, but, I mean, yeah, that's right.
The navigator pulled out too at the last minute.
Yeah, so, well, one of the navigators did. There was Don Bennett, who later went on to great fame, I think, as a pathfinder navigator in the Second World War. Mm. But, yeah, he pulled out of one, and Bill said, right, Bill was going to fly the Faith in Australia. But when the navigator got sick and Smithy said, I'll take one aeroplane, Bill decided to go as a navigator/pilot in the cross.
As you say, Taylor had begged Smithy to take another plane. Smithy refused. Why did Bill Taylor go on this when all the signs were bad?
I think he wanted to support Smithy. I think he adored Smithy. You know, adored's the wrong word. He admired him. He thought he was a great bloke. And they were mates. They'd flown the Pacific together. They'd had all sorts of adventures. And he wanted to support Smithy. And also, underlying it all, is this isn't another adventure. Although they were trying to make it appear routine, and there, I think there'd been 11 or 12 crossings at the Tasman only at that stage. It's not a lot. So there was still a bit of adventure in it, and also Bill could navigate. He liked navigating.
When did they first spot trouble?
They were about, I think it was about five hours into the flight, they were heading east. And just before, not quite dawn, Bill Taylor took over from Smithy. Smithy went down below for a bit of a rest, and the Southern Cross had three engines, one in the nose and one on either wing. And Bill was sitting looking at the engine in front of him, and he was looking at the red glow of the exhaust manifold, and suddenly he noticed a little brighter orange glow in the middle of the red. And as he watched, that glow got bigger and bigger, then it came, became a split. And he could see, well, something's going to happen with that exhaust manifold shortly. It was the weld along the weld line. Smithy came back up into the cockpit, and Bill had just shown him what was going on when the manifold failed. And there was a loud roar, and a piece of metal detached itself from the engine and flew into the right-hand engine. Instantly, the whole aeroplane, just this terrific shuddering took over the aircraft, and it threatened to shake itself to pieces. Smithy knew at once what had happened. A piece of that metal had gone through and shattered the propeller, which then was out of balance.
What would it have been like in the plane at that point?
Oh, absolutely terrifying. The whole thing would have been shaking, and the noise would have been terrific from the roar of the exhaust, the open exhaust, which is now shattered. Smithy immediately throttled back, shut that engine down, but the plane still shook because the airstream was windmilling the propeller like the out-of-balance propeller like a fan. So what he did was he pulled the nose up to get the speed off, to get the Southern Cross, slow it down so that the propeller would stop spinning. Now, at that slow speed, the aeroplane could barely fly, so he was just above stalling speed on two engines. He said to immediately turn it round and headed back to Sydney.
So they've got two engines. And they're heading back to Sydney. Yep. So things are looking okay.
Well, the aeroplane's flying, but they're not going to make their mail trip.
They're not going to New Zealand.
They're not going to New Zealand.
They've turned back for Australia, but things might be all right.
They might be all right. So Smithy said, give me a course. So Bill gave him a course which would put them out of any headwinds to make the most advantage. There was a big crosswind, I think. And then they worked out how much fuel they could dump. So they dumped the fuel. And then Smithy said, chuck out anything but not the mail. So they opened the door and threw out all sorts of bits and pieces that they had on board. And that was okay. They were managing the status quo was okay. They were heading back to Sydney. The aeroplane was under control, very slowly, of course. It was going to take them 11 hours to get back. And then Bill Taylor happened to notice on the left-hand engine, that's the one, number one engine, blue smoke. He thought, hello, that engine's using too much oil.
Burning oil.
They all burn oil. All aero engines burn oil, but this was burning more than it should. Mm. And he pointed it out to Smithy, and that's bad, because if they lose that engine, they can't fly. What are we going to do? And Bill Taylor then got the idea that the right-hand engine with the smashed propeller had a full oil tank. And he thought, we've got to get oil or we're going to go down into the sea. So he got out of his seat, which was on the right-hand side, and he climbed out into the slipstream. It was about, 120 miles an hour, so maybe 200 knots, 200 kilometres an hour slipstream.
And he climbs onto the wing of a moving plane.
He climbs onto the strut, and he leant his neck against the leading edge of the wing, and the slipstream held him against the wing, and he edged his way across to the engine. Halfway across, he had to let go all his handhold and just he was tempted to make a dash for it, but he didn't. He just edged across. Then he thought, right, I've reached the engine, now I've got to get the oil out. Now, the wireless operator, a man called John Stanage, had a flask, a thermos flask. He handed that out to Bill Taylor and a spanner. First the spanner. Fortunately, the nut on the sump oil was not, the sump drain was not too tight, so he drained the oil out into the thermos flask, handed it back across into the aircraft. Stanage then filled up a leather briefcase, which had been held some wireless spares. They got rid of those, and they filled up this briefcase with oil. And he kept passing the thing back out to Taylor till the briefcase was filled.
And how difficult would it have been physically for Taylor to hang on?
Tremendously difficult. Oil slippery as well. It's so difficult that some people actually question whether it happened. Well, it absolutely did happen, because I've done a lot of careful research on this. A lot of the oil would have been lost, sucked away in the slipstream, but they managed to get enough.
But there are key moments where he's having to let go with his hands, and he's covered in slippery oil, and they're travelling along at...
90 miles, what's that, about 200 kilometres an hour, I suppose.
And how close to the ocean are they?
They were quite low, just a few hundred feet. It was pretty hairy stuff. So then Bill got back inside, and then he thought, gee, I've got to get the oil. We got the oil inside now. Now I've got to get it into the number one engine, which is losing the oil. So Smithy hopped over into the right-hand seat, and Bill climbed out the left-hand side. And he did the same trick, but this time that engine's running. So he's subject to the full blast of the slipstream of that propeller. So Smithy understood at once what the problem was. So he edged the cross up a few hundred feet, then throttle back on that engine. Well, immediately it started to come down, of course. But in that brief interval, Bill managed to get across, open the oil filler thing, and pour the oil into that engine. He did that six times. I think it was six times, five or six times. That whole procedure, going out to each engine. Instantly, the engine picked up. The oil pressure rose. The needle rose on the dial, and he saved the aeroplane.
And he saved Smithy.
Yep, he saved the aeroplane and Smithy. And at the last minute, the number one engine started to burn oil as well. And they couldn't reach that to top it up. So Smithy said, dump the mail. So they dumped the mail, unfortunately. But they limped in. And Bill Taylor was a real hero for doing that. And he got the George Cross for that.
Which is the highest civilian honour for courage you can receive.
It was initially the British Empire Medal, and then George VI changed it to the George Cross.
Yeah. Tragically, Smithy had just 5 months to live. As you say, he'd long had a fear of being lost over water, and that's precisely what happened to him in 1935, and he was never found. What impact did that have on Bill Taylor?
It absolutely devastated him, and he joined a search to find Smithy. He chartered an aeroplane from Sydney and flew up. They were going to go up to that area and search it, but in Cloncurry, when he went up to, they refueled the aeroplane and he had a night's sleep. He felt strange the next morning, so he went to the doctor and the doc said, you're not flying, you're grounded. And it was all the years of stress and strain and had caught up with him. And he had to take quite a few months off flying. Mm. And it tore him apart because he wanted to go and search for Smithy. Of course, the search was inconclusive. They never did find Smithy and the aeroplane. But Bill Taylor was so traumatised by all that he couldn't sleep for many months. And he finally decided the only way to do it was to fly and fly and fly and fly. So he bought himself a Gull aeroplane and he flew all over Australia on charter jobs, and that cured himself of the monkey that was on his back.
And so what are we to make of him out on that wing over the Tasman, covered in oil, 200 kilometres an hour, metres above the sea? Is he an Indiana Jones sort of figure?
No, it's typical Bill Taylor. Something has to be done. I'm a resolute person. This is what I reckon we'll do. I'll just do it. He actually says that in his book somewhere, one of his passages in his books. It had to be done. He didn't think how intrepid he was being or anything like that. He didn't even think how scary it was. He just did it. He focused on what he was doing.
And how was he received by the Australian public with that news?
Oh, well, he was a hero, of course. Yeah. He's a real hero. He's quite a high-profile person for probably a decade and a half with his books and his escapades. But for some reason, he's sunk out of the consciousness of the Australian public over the years.
And finally, to the soul of the man. I mean, he was the only one of that grand trio, Charles Ulm, Charles Kingsford Smith and Bill Taylor. Bill was the only one to die as an old man in his bed after many more adventures. He could have seen his flying as the thing that brought him so much grief. But it wasn't, was it?
No, it brought him solace. He was a very spiritual man, and he found great spiritual peace in the air at night above a vast ocean, where communicating with the stars, which told him where he was, and the hum of the engines, which after a while becomes totally imperceptible. And that to him was absolute heaven on earth.
And did he fly to the end of his life?
No, he lost his pilot's license because he had angina. And he struggled very much towards the end of his life. And he wrote a very heartfelt letter to his doctor about his heart problems. And he said, look, I've had three marriages. I've made all these big flights. I've fought governments to let me do these survey flights through my life. No wonder I've got a bad heart. He didn't say it like that. It was very moving. And it's in the book, the passage.
But the doctor didn't relent?
Oh, no. No, Dr. Shute was his name in London, Ontario. No, and Bill didn't say, please give me my license back. He knew. He said, if I have a heart attack when I'm in the air, that's irresponsible. That's typical Bill Taylor again.
Yeah.
He accepted it.
And from that little boy that we started off talking about on Lion Island, who was making a life messing about in boats, was aviation really the making of Bill Taylor?
I think largely Bill Taylor was the making of aviation in Australia a little bit, with his risk management and his big overwater pioneering flights. I don't think it was the making of him, but it was his thing. He needed to do it and he did it.
And a wonderful story of its time. Thank you so much for coming in and being my guest today.
Thanks, Ellen.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.